From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I moved around the corner from Spike in 1985. I'd met him, I think, briefly before that at a party. And he was trying to finish. He showed me he lived in a little apartment in Brooklyn, a very small one room, basically. And he had an editing machine. And he showed me what was in the work in progress of She's Gotta Have It, which I loved. Never seen anything like it. And I would go on to invest some money in the project and then help him, you know, raise some other money. And, you know, the film turned out to be quite an historic event. It started his career and helped jumpstart the black film movement of the time, and was really, really, you know, and looking back on it, it was just a lot of kind of a fortunate accident that I ended up around the corner from Spike, and it ended up changing my life.
Nelson George, acclaimed filmmaker, TV producer, journalist, and author of The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style, published by HarperCollins Publishers. When it debuted in October 1971, 7 years after the Civil Rights Act, Soul Train boldly went where no other variety show had gone before, showcasing the cultural preferences of young African Americans and the sound that defines their lives, R&B, funk, jazz, disco, and gospel music. The brainchild of Chicago radio announcer Don Cornelius, the show's producer and host, Soul Train featured a diverse range of stars. The Hippest Trip in America tells the full story of this pop culture phenomenon that appealed not only to African Americans, but to a wide crossover audience as well. George's book is a vivid and vital portrait of a revered cultural institution, the longest running syndicated program in television history that has left an indelible mark on our national consciousness. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Hippest Trip in America, with Nelson George in Black America.
There had never been a show that came on every week on American TV that promoted the joy and ecstasy and style of Black America before Soul Train. Not like that. Not every week, not into your living room, not without any white mediation. The dances were black, the music was black, the style was black, even the commercials were black. That had never been done before in American TV. And it was a sensation that touched black souls, inspired white spirits, and changed the nature of how people saw celebration. So that to this day, you can go to a party anywhere in the globe, actually, and they might have a Soul Train line. So it's just a profound, it was a profound impact that it lingers in and continues to inspire.
Few television programs were as innovative and influential as Soul Train. Beginning first in Chicago and later in Los Angeles, Soul Train reached national significance and became the longest-running syndicated program in television history. Everyone knew that Don Cornelius had ambition. He was a car salesman, policeman, and insurance agent before his deep voice led him to WVON radio in 1966 as a newsreader and street reporter. He made the transition to TV 2 years later, and he soon realized there was a need for a black TV show. He presented the idea, then found major corporate sponsorship, and on October 2, 1991, Soul Train appeared locally in the Windy City. Soul Train is best remembered for introducing the Soul Train line into the cultural lexicon and was responsible for presenting a positive image of Black America for Black America in a time of social upheaval and unrest. Memories of the assassinations of Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Kennedys were still fresh on the national consciousness. Soul Train's message of love, peace, and soul resonated for 35 years. In his book, The Hippest Trip in America, Nelson George tells the full story of this landmark program of black music and culture.
What was life like? I mean, it was good, man. I'm alive.
I understand. And when did you develop that interest in writing and journalism?
Well, my writing came. My mother was always interested in literature and books and so forth. And when I was very young, she actually taught me how to read even before I was going to school. So she had already sort of gotten me in the habit. And throughout my childhood, I got really interested in literature and storytelling. I got into journalism purely when I was in high school, really, because it just seemed like a good way to meet people, quite honestly. I felt like you get to go around school and ask people questions, and no one, you know, thinks it's weird if you're doing for the school newspaper. So that sort of was my introduction to journalism, and it kind of went from there.
And you worked at Billboard for a while. How did you get that gig?
Well, I was an intern in college. When I was in college, I had two internships. One at Billboard Magazine, and one at the Amsterdam News, black newspaper.
Right.
And so I did both. So both those worlds, I went to school during the day. I would run up to either the Amsterdam News, usually first in Harlem, and then go down to Billboard Magazine in Midtown Manhattan. And from my sophomore, junior, and senior years, those 3 years, that's more or less what I did. So it was very much my education. So it wasn't just Billboard. It was both the black experience of the Amsterdam News and sort of the music experience of Billboard that both kind of came together and gave me my training.
During your time at Billboard, what are some of the highlights you believe happened during your tenure there as far as black music is concerned?
Oh, man, that's a long time. I was there from 19. I wrote on and off for Billboard, Record World, and Billboard from 1980 to 1989, so the three easiest things to mention would be Michael Jackson, Prince, and hip-hop. But also, Anita Baker, Whitney Houston, both debuted during that time. Solar Records had an incredible run. There was a lot. There was an incredible period. But those would be the bigger stories. I covered all of those.
How was your involvement with Spike Lee's debut feature, She's Gotta Have It?
I moved around the corner from Spike in 1985. I'd met him, I think, briefly before that at a party.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to finish. He showed me he lived in a little apartment in Brooklyn, a very small one room, basically. And he had an editing machine. And he showed me what was then the work in progress of She's Gotta Have It, which I loved. Never seen anything like it. And I would go on to invest some money in the project and then help him, you know, raise some other money. And, you know, the film turned out to be quite an historic event. Right. It started his career and helped jumpstart the black film movement of the time. And was really, really, you know, and looking back on it, it was just a lot of kind of a fortunate accident that I ended up around the corner from Spike, and it ended up changing my life.
Speaking today of the James Brown biopic, and you've written the James Brown Reader about The Godfather. Have you had a chance to preview the movie?
Yeah, I've seen it.
and your opinion of it.
It's okay. It's entertaining. I don't necessarily think it's I don't necessarily think it's really The Godfather. I think it is a entertaining Hollywood version of The Godfather.
Understand that you have just written a book, The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style. And
I mean, the book came out like early this year, in February, so it's been out a while.
It's been out a while. What brought you to that junction that you needed to throw your, so to say, hat in the ring on Don Cornelius?
Well, he's a Chicago boy. He always had a sense of cool. Chicago's one of those cities that always had a very strong sense of self. He became a radio DJ. That voice, of course, the deep voice he had made him a natural. Initially, he did a lot of news reporting in Chicago because there was so much competition for jobs. And he would do these parties, you know, for high school kids, because back in that era, a lot of DJs or radio DJs would make extra money doing sock hops in those days. And because he was going all over town, taking a train across Chicago, it became the Soul Train. And so when he got the idea of doing a local TV show, it became the Soul Train.
Well, after Don's death, I was approached by a publisher about doing a book on Soul Train. And I felt like it was a good idea, obviously. The problem at the time was that Don's passing took away access to the chief source of information.
Right.
But luckily, I had some friends at VH1. They had done a really excellent documentary on Soul Train just about 2 years ago, 2 years before he died. I was able to get access to they did a really mammoth interview with Don, most of which didn't make it into the show. So I was able to get access to that. And that really, that was really crucial because I didn't think I could do the book without that kind of access. And so it was really, that was really crucial. And once that came through, then I was able to contact a lot of the other Soul Train dancers, people like Marco de Santiago, Anita Jo Freeman, Rosie Perez, and they really gave me a lot of firsthand insight into their experience there.
What, in your opinion, made Soul Train such a revolutionary television program?
There had never been a show that came on every week on American TV that promoted the joy and ecstasy and style of Black America before Soul Train. Not like that. Not every week, not into your living room, not without any white mediation. The dances were Black, the music was Black, the style was Black, even the commercials were Black. That had never been done before in American TV. And it was a sensation that touched Black souls, inspired white spirits, and changed the nature of how people saw celebration. So that to this day, you can go to a party anywhere in the globe, actually.
Right.
And they might have a Soul Train line. So it's just a profound impact that it lingers and continues to inspire.
A lot of individuals such as myself and you know Soul Train as a television program. But behind the scenes, Don Cornelius was an astute businessman.
Don was a rarity in American culture in that he owned the show. It was his show. He started it. He didn't have any other partners. And he was very, very strong with, you know, he picked the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
He picked the music. He's involved in the graphics. He would help decide where dancers should be on the stage, which ones got to be on the Soul Train line, which ones didn't. So it's kind of unusual in a world where, you know, very few Black people have control of their image, that Don had total control of what went on the show, how it was viewed, and how it worked. So it's still to this day quite unusual to have that kind of control.
People don't even really think about syndicated TV now because of cable's dominance. But that was the other way in. And if you were able to find a sponsor who would get you enough money to produce the content, there were enough independent TV stations around the country that were looking for shows that you could make that sale. And Don was able to do that. It took him, I mean, the thing is, we point out in the book, it wasn't like immediately Soul Train went national. The initial 71, it wasn't or everywhere in 1971. It took several years before it had truly national coverage. And even then, in certain markets like Philadelphia, where Questlove talks about the fact it comes on almost at midnight for you know in its initial introduction to Philadelphia. So it was a slow rollout those first 3 years.
Don's connection to the music world in the beginning was difficult for artists to accept an invitation to Soul Train. Back in the beginning, the OJs were frequent performers, then Gladys Knight and the Pips. And ironically, as we speak, the James Brown movie. And once James Brown and some others came on the program, a lot of more artists wanted to be on Soul Train.
Well, I mean, definitely in the beginning, he was an untested commodity.
Okay.
There had never been anything like it before. A lot of managers and people with the acts didn't know what to make of it. So there was definitely that hurdle to leap over. The OJs were definitely one of his earlier supporters who really had Don's back throughout his journey. And I think they were the group that appeared on Soul Train more than any other group. So they really had him. When James Brown came on, John felt it was really significant because he was the cutting edge of what black pop culture was, and you weren't really doing a black music show until you had The Godfather on. So it was a profound thing for him. And so that's about a second year, it took him until maybe the second year that the thing really came together. And when that happened, the sky was the limit after that. Everyone who was anybody in the game had to be on Soul Train.
Who were some of the individuals that helped Don make that transition from Chicago to Los Angeles?
One of the most important was Clarence Avant.
Okay.
Who is now considered one of the godfathers of black music behind the scenes forces. And he really helped as a manager and as a talent scout and as a businessman. He had Don's back throughout. He's the one who negotiated the actual sale of Soul Train when Don finally sold it. And so Clarence Avant, who managed Jimmy and Terry at one point, he been partners with Quincy Jones for years. Anything to do with black music coming in L.A., Clarence has had a role in, and he definitely was very important to Don.
Who were some of the venues in which Don sought out to find his dancers?
Well, the most famous one is Maverick Flat on Crenshaw and South Central. It was the number one black club in L.A. in the 70s. And, you know, all the great bands played there, Earth and Fire, Richard Pryor would do comedy there. But for the dancers, it was like a mecca. And Don's talent scouts found Don Campbell there. They found Meter Joe Freeman there. That whole first wave of great Soul Train dancers who helped to find the show, the majority of them came through Maverick Flat, so which actually had been closed for a while, but now is open. If you go to Los Angeles, you can go to Maverick Flat, and the place still looks a lot like it did back in the 70s.
All right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Nelson George, filmmaker, TV producer, columnist, music and culture critic, journalist, and author. Mr. George, when you sat down to write the book about Soul Train, what were some of the immediate memories that you went through as a kid growing up watching the program?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my sister was a couple of years younger than me and a very big dancer. And on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. on a local New York station, Soul Train would come on. We'd sit in front of it, first in front of one of those black and white TVs, and then a little mini color Trinitron, because those things were tiny at the time. And we would watch the show and watch the moves, and we would know that afternoon and that night in the schoolyards and house parties, people would try and do Soul Train moves. They would attempt to get their hair the right way. The Soul Train dancers had the afros and those crazy colors. I mean, one thing that you really saw when you saw Soul Train was vibrant. The set was vibrant. The colors of the dancers was quite dynamic. It was California style brought into homes in New York, Detroit, Atlanta, and affected everything. So Soul Train not only entertained us, but it was a guide for style, a guide for dancing, and a guide to music. So it was a very 360 cultural experience. I mean, it was a real glue. I mean, I think the thing about, one of the many things about Soul Train is that it solidified national black culture. When I say that, I mean to say there'd never been a regularly scheduled vehicle ever for black music, black style, black entertainment in TV. It had never been done. When it comes on 1971, we're in black power era. We're in an era where we have black mayors finally getting to be black mayors in major cities. We still have the black power. The riots of the 60s are still very, very vivid in the minds of everyone. So what Soul Train did was take black joy, the excitement, the vitality, the spirit of soul music, of black music, of funk, of the beginnings of disco, and put it here in a format for everyone could enjoy in their living room. It took the idea of blackness and took it away from the news as strife or as conflict and made it accessible not just to black people, but also to white corporations, because you began seeing slowly advertising on Soul Train. I mean, the thing about Soul Train was that it wasn't just that the dancers and the music was black, but you began seeing black commercials.
Who were some of the individuals that came to Don's aid when other entities tried to replicate what he was doing?
Well, I mentioned Clarence Avant earlier, and Clarence Avant was able to, who was a major music business figure, was able to go to ABC when Dick Clark launched his own fake Soul Train show, Soul Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to get to them. I mean, people don't remember this, but Dick did about, I think it was 5 shows of Soul Unlimited, which was a direct threat to Soul Train. With Dick Clark's clout, the fact that it was on ABC, it really could have damaged Soul Train permanently. And Clarence was able to cajole, persuade, threaten, and otherwise get ABC to stop the show. J.C. Jackson also played a role in talking about boycotting ABC. So a lot of folks stepped up to protect Soul Train from Dick Clark and his monopoly on music TV.
What was the reception that you received when you put the feelers out to talk to some of the former Soul Train dancers and how their careers had progressed, particularly Sharon Hill and the lead singer for Lakeside?
Oh, you mean Mark Wood?
Mark Wood, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they were all great. Everyone was fantastic. It's been a really great reception. Folks have been really good about the book. I was able to get a lot of access to the interviews from the VH1 special and also get a lot of additional interviews. It's a great, you know, it's a great community. They're very tight-knit. There's still a lot of party. There was just a party this past weekend here in Los Angeles that featured a lot of the original Soul Train dancers. So there's a they have a great, the ones who are still in contact, Tyrone Proctor, who lives in New York, but he's teaches whacking as a sort of an innovative whack dancing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are really have amazing spirit. They have great affection for Soul Train, and they know what being on the show did for their lives. Very aware of that, very, you know, very, very positive, affirmative people. So I found it to be quite a great experience.
Besides your literary talent, you're also a television producer, and what comes to mind offhand is American Gangster. How did you get that project off the ground?
Well, Reggie Hudlin, who was then president at BET, and I talked about it we had talked about a show like that for a long time. When he was able to get that job, he came to me and said, you know, it's time for us to try and make it happen. In conjunction with a really talented group of producer writers, mostly based out of Los Angeles, we were able to make the show happen. The same team, in fact, that worked in American Gangster also works on Unsung on TV1, which is a really good show. So it was a really great team up, combination of Reggie's vision for it and working with a really great team of people who really wanted to make it happen.
When you look at the entertainment industry, what are some of the things that you appreciate that they're doing right now, and are there any disappointments that you've thus experienced?
Well, I mean, it's a whole lifetime. There's always disappointments. But I would say this, that there's a lot of great stuff going on right now. Black film is made a big comeback, and it's making money at the box office, which is very important. And then you have, you know, an historic number of black, you know, you have Scandal, which is, you know, an amazing show. You have Shonda Rhimes, who's going to have three shows back-to-back-to-back on a Thursday night, almost unprecedented for anybody, and certainly unprecedented for anybody black. So there's a lot of stuff to feel good about, quite honestly. I think this has been, there's been a big upswing in the amount of black imagery and the success of black imagery in this era. And I think that's important, and I'm hopeful that this will continue on.
I understand that you're currently working on a project out there currently?
I'm working on a TV show for Netflix.
And can you give us a little idea what that program is going to be about?
Not much. I can only say that it's set in the 70s in New York City. It will involve the birth of hip-hop and the fiscal crisis that hit New York so hard in the 70s. And so it won't be on the air for another year at least. So it's a ways off.
Any other television projects that continuing that you're working on?
No, this is taking up all my time right now.
All right. Any final comments, Mr. George?
No, thank you for having me.
And that just did it for this edition. We thank you for joining us. Let's do it again next week on these same stations. And you can bet your last money, it's all going to be a stone dust. Honey, I'm Don Cornelius, and as always, in parting, we wish you love, peace, and...
Nelson George, author of The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today, and please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 1 University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.